From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. This is proving to be a deadly day in Gaza. At the same time as the U.S. Embassy opening ceremony is held in Jerusalem, the move of the embassy formally recognizes Jerusalem by the United States as the capital of Israel. It's one of a number of dramatic foreign policy moves by the U.S. president and his administration. Let's check in with the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Hello, Ken. Glad to talk with you again.
Good morning, Beth.
So from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, the U.S. formally moves the embassy. And let's put into perspective how important this is politically for the president here in the United States.
I mean, this is a campaign promise that Donald Trump has meant from the beginning, that he felt that. You see, a lot of politicians have said this over the years, that the U.S. embassy should be moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. But given the fact that Jerusalem is a divided city, it's the fact that both sides, the Israelis and the Palestinians, are fighting over Jerusalem, that it's split between East and West Jerusalem, it's just a controversial issue. And so many presidents may have suggested doing some kind of move, but it never happened because of the repercussions. And we're seeing today in Gaza some of those repercussions. The fact that I guess as many as 52 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces trying to break the barrier in Gaza. But going back to politically, it seems like the people who want this move the most are the more religious Jewish community in this country, which supported in large part President Trump because he's a very, very hawkish on the state of Israel, far more than the Democrats and Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were. And the evangelical Christians who have always seen Israel as the kind of place where perhaps the resurrection of Jesus Christ could appear. But for most secular Jews, they just feel that if anybody proposing a lasting peace in the area, and I don't know how this is ever going to happen, but certainly the fact that by waving the red flag at a bull by putting the embassy in Jerusalem, it seems to be inflaming Palestinian tempers and making peace prospects even less likely than they were before.
I'll add to those reports, Ken, that the reports are that now more than 1,600 people have been wounded, and these demonstrations are happening along the fence in the edges of Gaza as the ceremony is still going on. There's been an increase in violence over the past 6 weeks. It might continue because tomorrow the Palestinians are going to mark being driven out during Israel's War of Independence. And I meant to say there it might continue at such a high level because of that. We'll continue to add reports throughout the day and, of course, following it on NPR News. That's Jerusalem. Go ahead.
Yeah, can I just add one thing, though, that the U.S. pastor who gave a blessing at the embassy, he was denounced by Mitt Romney and others as being an extremist. He's the one who said that you can't be saved by being a Jew. I mean, this guy is he said, notably anti-Semitic and anti-Mormon statements in the past. And this is just, again, it's the base that Donald Trump is appealing to is really more the evangelical Christian community who always see it's less about Jews and more about Israel. But politically around the world, you see when other leaders saying this is a big mistake, this will only inflame tensions. It's like abrogating the deal with Iran. Our U.S. allies in Western Europe, led by President Macron in France, pleaded with Trump not to end that deal, and the president went with his gut. He went with his gut on Israel. He went with his gut on Iran, and that's basically his foreign policy.
Well, in addition to saying the president went with his gut, the two other phrases we hear are he's speaking to his base or he's keeping a campaign promise. And that's why I asked you that first question.
Well, yes, and that is the case. But then you look at what's going on with the sanctions in China, where the president reversed himself because he was afraid that one company, the telecommunications company in China, may lose tens of thousands of jobs, the ZTE Corporation. He said, look, I don't want to put this company out of business, which is remarkable given the fact that the president talking about campaign promises, has always talked about punishing China for its unfair trade practices. So sometimes the president could really stick to his guns and stay with his campaign rhetoric and his beliefs. And then, like we saw with the sanctions in China, and look at what's happening in North Korea, he could just change on a dime.
Let's shift to that discussion. This happened since we talked last weekend that there will now be a summit in Singapore. The LA Times has had an article describing how Singapore, I guess, won the location of the summit, which makes it sound like there was a pitch. There were bids by other areas. And this small little island of Singapore landed what might be one of the most historic meetings in modern times.
Yeah, it's almost like bidding for the Olympics. It is, because you have these two superpowers and you have to put North Korea as a superpower, given the fact that it's a nuclear power. But this is why predicting American foreign policy is so difficult, not only for our allies, but even for people in this country. Because if you think just a couple of months ago, remember, Kim Jong-un was a madman. He was little rocket man. And the president was talking about World War III as if it were as a casual walk in the sun, walk in the park. And now he's talking about how Kim Jong-un was so excellent in freeing those three Korean-American prisoners that Kim Jong-un is now very honorable. And look, for all we know, this could be an amazingly historic a summit meeting June 12th in Singapore. And if that's the case, then President Trump deserves all the credit in the world. But that's what just makes this man so remarkably difficult to predict. And we shouldn't even be trying to predict anything, but just watching him is so amazing, because you don't know what he's going to say next. Yes, he does keep his campaign promises, as we saw with immigration and climate change and certainly the Iranian deal. And then he could be so baffling inconsistent as he was with North Korea. So we watch him, our jaw is, dropped. And
he can,
and
in the meantime, between May 23rd and May 25th, all of the tunnels in this nuclear test site are going to be collapsed. And North Korea over the weekend said it's not only going to allow but welcome journalists from all over the world to witness this. What do you make of this, especially considering the power of some of the previous nuclear test sites were so powerful and possibly destructive to the environment that the whole world was concerned?
Well, all I can say is let's wait and see. I'm not going to say that this is a setup. I'm not going to say that Kim Jong-un is using Donald Trump. I'm not going to say this is propaganda. I don't think we need to say in advance for anything what may happen. It's just nothing short of remarkable, as I said, that 6 months ago we were talking about World War III, and now here we are in May of 2018, and we're talking about the Nobel Peace Prize for Trump and or Kim. So it's just, look, if it happens, if it's a denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, that's great news. It's fantastic news. If it happens, and all we can say is we'll wait and see.
Who do you think is more savvy here, the North Korean leader or the United States leader?
Well, I get upset with myself that I find myself thinking, like, I believe Stormy Daniels and I don't believe the president. I mean, this is what's going on in this surreal world of politics.
Wow, you just made a real shift there, Ken.
No, but I'm saying the fact is I kind of think that Kim Jong-un is, I mean, look, I think that Kim Jong-un has come to the table because of Trump's bellicose threats. I mean, I don't think he could have come to the table without it. But the fact that the president is so willing now to believe Kim and to call him excellent and very honorable is that sometimes I think that the president, for all his bluster, can be very naive. Look, the fact that his best friend is now Kanye West makes me think that the president just likes people who says nice things to him and about him. So I think, look, Kim Jong-un is no fool, and he has China's backing at all costs. I don't know what's happening.
Well, we're all at the mercy of what we know on the outside. We don't know what's going on in private. So thanks for trying to answer that question anyway.
I'm trying my best.
That was one that probably didn't have an answer. I'm talking with Ken Rudin, the political junkie, by the way. I hope you've had a nice time honoring and celebrating your dear mom. Hope she's doing all right.
Yes, thank you. She's actually here for the week, so that's wonderful. She had to leave the terrible weather of gorgeous sunny Florida,
right?
But she's here for the week, and this weekend was my son's graduation party here, so she attended that, and I'm very blessed to have her, and it was a great Mother's Day, but thank you so much. I hope yours was wonderful as
well. Yes, it was. Congratulations to your family for all of that. Also, since we spoke last week, Ken, there were primaries across the country, four which were being watched in particular last week. So let's talk a bit about that, because Politico wrote in the very first line of one of its latest articles, "Republicans can exhale now."
Well, I think that's a bit premature, but what they're referring to is that there was a Roy Moore-type candidate. Roy Moore, of course, being the very controversial guy in Alabama who lost a safe Republican seat to Democrat Doug Jones because of his past. Now, Roy Jones, of course, was accused of sexually abusing young girls or propositioning young girls. That's not what Don Blankenship was accused of in West Virginia. He was controversial because he was the head of a coal mine that exploded. 29 miners were killed. He went to prison for a year for his role in it. He's really very, very controversial. He'll talk about one of his targets during the campaign was not only Mitch McConnell, who he called Cocaine Mitch. And that's a long story, not even worth reporting. But he talked about Mitch McConnell's wife and her family, calling them China people, like he's a China man and a China person. And this is rhetoric from maybe 1840. I mean, I don't know, but he's just very controversial. And basically, if the Republicans hope to defeat Joe Manchin in November, the Democratic incumbent, they weren't going to do it with Blankenship. Politico said they dodged a bullet, and they did dodge a bullet, and they probably do breathe easier now that Blankenship finished third in the primary. That's no guarantee that he'll win, the Patrick Morrissey, the Republican who won the primary, will beat Manchin in November, but it does save the Republicans from the embarrassment of having a Don Blankenship represent them on the ballot in November.
And that's why West Virginia was in the news, obviously. We've got more big primaries coming up still in May, and then in June we have a number of states, including California and Nevada. I want to skip ahead to the California gubernatorial debate, which happened last week in San Jose. And I know you were keeping your eye on that debate. Six candidates, four Democrats, two Republicans, and the Republicans are battling fiercely. Have you followed the narrative?
Well, obviously, as you know, as your audience knows, that the election law in California is different, that all the candidates are on the same ballot and the top two finishers go on to the general election runoff in November. Republicans are very fearful of being shut out of this. And the fact that, I mean, we saw for the first time 2 years ago when Kamala Harris was elected to the Senate, there were two Democrats. It was Loretta Sanchez and Kamala Harris. No Republican made the final two. The two Republicans now, John Cox and Travis Allen, are desperately trying to make it into the top two. And if they don't, you know, you mentioned earlier about the death of George Duke Majan. When George, I was thinking back in the 1980s and 1990s when Duke Majan would win two terms as governor, followed by Pete Wilson for two terms as governor. That's 16 consecutive years of Republican governors. The thought of California going through one year, let alone 16 years as Republicans, that shows how far the Republican Party has fallen. So the debate was fascinating. It seems to be all about Gavin Newsom and who could beat him and who could stop him and who could wind up in the runoff with him to make it past the June 5th primary. But I think by all accounts, Newsom has the lead in the multi-candidate ballot. And the question is whether the second person will be another fellow Democrat, perhaps Antonio Villaraigosa, the former L.A. mayor. It seems like a long shot now for the Republicans to make it to the runoff, but they are desperate to do so. But look, when you have Republicans when you have Republicans who are white supremacists or Holocaust deniers or things like that, I mean, the Republican Party was never extreme in California. When you think of even Ronald Reagan, who raised taxes, and, you know, those days of Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, and It was a conservative state, but it was not an ultra conservative state. And when you have Republicans running so far to the right, maybe that's what happens in the year of in the era of Trump. When you have Republicans so far to the right, they get shut out of these elections, and it's driving the establishment party, the Republican Party in California, crazy.
On the subject of George Duke Majan, do you want to give me a few of your thoughts? Because that was such a lively campaign and election, very close the first time when George Duke Majan was elected, and he had the same opponent when he was reelected.
That's right. You know, Duke Majan, of course, the former two-term governor who died last week. There's something I've read all these tributes to him, and yes, he was very conservative, and yes, he fought was an anti-crime guy, and he cut spending, and he hated new taxes, and he was a real law and order guy. But people liked him. He had respect on both sides. He was a gracious, honest politician who definitely reached across party lines. I mean, obviously, when he was first elected in '82, one of his targets was the outgoing governor, a guy by the name of Jerry Brown. You may remember him. He was governor back in the 1970s. But even Jerry Brown said that he was a very honest man and very well liked. What was fascinating about the Duke Majan race in 1982, when he ran against L.A. Mayor Tom Bradley, who was, of course, hoping to become the first African-American governor of California, people talked about one of the reasons Bradley lost. He only lost by 60,000 votes, or something like that, 60,000 votes out of nearly 8 million cast. Mm. And basically what this was the story, no, I'm sorry, 90,000 votes, right, yeah. Out of 8 million cast. And they talked about the Bradley effect that people would tell pollsters that they really didn't want to say they were voting against a black candidate. So they told pollsters they would vote for Bradley, but ultimately they voted for Duke Majan, and that's why Bradley lost. That's not why Bradley lost. The reason Duke Majan won, why Bradley lost, there was something on the ballot then called Proposition 15, which was basically, it was an anti-gun amendment that said that all handgun owners should register with the Department of Justice. It would freeze new purchases of handguns. Tom Bradley was leading in the polls until he endorsed that Proposition 15. Once he endorsed it, the Duke Majan people went, very effectively tied Tom Bradley with government taking your guns. And it outraged a lot of conservatives, outraged a lot of farmers, and that an anti-Bradley vote came in at the last second, not on race, not on bad polling, but I think because of this gun measure. The gun lobby was so strong, gun owners were so strong in 1982, they put Duke Majan over the top. And for all the controversy about that election and how close it was, as I said, by only about 90,000 votes out of 8 million cast, he was never a mean guy. There was no retribution. There was no animosity. He was a decent guy. And even when he ran against Bradley again 4 years later, when he won with 60, he won by 2 million votes 4 years later, it just showed that California liked the job that Duke Majan did. And he'll be remembered as one of the most thoughtful, most honest, most decent, and good guy governors. Whether you liked his conservative politics or not, a good guy. And we desperately need good guys in politics these days.
Good people. Let's amend that to just say good people.
Good people.
Thank you so much, Ken. I think we'll leave it there for today, and I look forward to talking to you next week.
Thank you, Beth.
Ken Rudin is the political junkie. You can find a link to his website at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio.